Thank you for flying Church of England, a Stargate Atlantis fan fiction by some instant. Consider, if you will, the universe. Take a moment or two, we'll wait. Right, so, universe considered, one comes to the conclusion that it is very large. Vast is probably a good word to use here, as the universe is most definitely bigger than a bread box. Bigger than most bread factories too, one imagines. And in this impressively vast, bigger than a bread box universe, there are things. Like galaxies, which contain solar systems, which contain stars and gravitational orbits and planets. And planets, sometimes, when the mood and chemical composition is right, contain life, which, very occasionally, takes the form of human beings. And, as someone important once said, or very nearly said, we're not entirely sure how the wording went, human beings contain multitudes. A lot of it's of goopy stuff. Ropey intestines and pudding-like brains and water and red blood cells and some salt and bacteria. But there's other, less gross stuff too, like ideas and ego and fear and hope, which makes up the more multitude-esque parts of humans. It's very crowded, being human. Now, just keep all that in mind. That was the prologue, so it's probably important, in a grand foreshadowing sort of way. Footnote 1. Unless we've all drawn the wrong conclusion, and the universe is actually very, very small, infinitely tiny, in which case, a bread factory, being bread factory-sized, would be larger than said universe. Except that the universe would then contain the bread factory, making the bread factory even more infinitely tiny than the universe. Unless the bread factory somehow exists outside of the known universe, but that is a supposition which is really just headache-causing and unnecessary. So let us, for the moment, assume that our first conclusion is correct, and the universe equals very large. Once upon a time, John Shepherd was forced to watch Waterworld with a girl he was not dating. It sucked for 136 minutes in 1995, and Shepherd wasn't terribly surprised to discover it could suck for two uninterrupted weeks on a planet many, many light years away from Kevin Costner. "You know," said Rodney, "you have very unattractive facial hair." He said this while laying in the middle of an ovoid canvas boat, surrounded by empty water skins and staring up at a sky that had two red suns in it. This was a bad idea, retinally speaking, but not as bad as it might have been. It was a fairly hazy day, and the suns looked like two lighter patches of greyish red in a wash of the same colour. "Shut up and give me your shoelaces, Rodney," Shepherd said. He was going to catch a fish. He really, really was. He'd read The Old Man and the Sea in ninth grade. He had a big mouth billy bass in storage somewhere in California, and he was fucking Air Force. Which had nothing to do with fishing, but still, he was fucking Air Force. A fish was not the boss of him. "I gave you my shoelaces 3 days ago," Rodney said. "You dangled them in the water for about half an hour, got bored, and then used them to play cat's cradle. I'm not sure, but it may have been an attempt to lure the fish into a false sense of security. In which case, I should point out, Colonel, that the fish is very secure at the moment, so feel free to surprise us all." Rodney continued to stare at the suns. "Want my sunglasses?" Shepherd asked. "Not really," McKay answered. Shepherd picked up the loop of shoelaces from the bottom of the boat and made cat's whiskers to distract the fish some more. Clearly it was still onto him, which is why he hadn't caught it yet. "Why don't you want my sunglasses, Rodney?" he asked. "Because I'm trying to blind myself so that I won't have to look at that hideous neckbeard of yours," McKay said steadily. "Gotcha," John said, and passed out, contented and delirious with sunstroke. Footnote 2. Okay, maybe dating. At least, she thought they were dating, and he thought they were just, you know, watching bad movies as a prelude to fucking, which is probably why the marriage didn't work out. A few days' worth of aloe and saline drips later, Dr. Weir said, "Sacred fish," and bit her lip. "Well," Shepherd said, "they said, catch the sacred fish or we gut Ronan and Taylor. So, you told them you'd catch the sacred fish," Dr. Weir finished. Shepherd nodded carefully. The neckbeard had been painful to shave off, what with the sunburn and gross peeling skin. "I mean, fishing trip or dead teammates. It seemed like an okay decision." "You did realise," Dr. Weir said, a tone saying, "Of course you didn't, you attractively bedheaded idiot, that E. Kayet was 93% ocean?" "Yes," said Shepherd, with wide, shifty eyes. "That was in the briefing, wasn't it?" Footnote 3. Point of fact, This is exactly the same defence Shepard used after that thing in Afghanistan. Substitute disobey orders for fishing trip. Add a petulant sounding sir after decision, and that's it, word for word. There are lots of theories surrounding the giant, all-encompassing why of the universe. Many of these place the blame, and credit, if there's any to be had, at the incorporeal feet of some sort of all-powerful deity or deities, who just up and decided to take a whole lot of nothing one day and make something of it. All the planets and humans and field mice and whatnot, according to most of these models, are around for a greater purpose. To teach something, to redeem something, to perfect something. These are very interesting theories, and a lot of very smart people believe in them. Some people, however, have slightly alternate views, arguing that it seems a little odd that omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, omni-whatever powers would feel the need to fiddle around with the universe, just to see what would happen. Especially given that, being omniscient, said powers would already know everything that could happen, ever. The logic here is difficult to ignore, for any number of people. So we have what appears to be a conflict. If A, not B. If B, not A. True or false? A death match, if you will, between faith and reason. One which demands that we all get up off our collective butts and choose a side. Except there has never, in the history of time entire, been a true-false exam that didn't have at least one trick question on it. Footnote 4. Encompassed in the all-encompassing why are basic existential questions like, why are we here? What is our purpose? Is there a God? If so, why does God hate us enough to allow the production of reality television? The Glietal were a formal, deliberate people. Greetings were complicated scripts that took an hour to complete. Trade negotiations meant one needed a detailed understanding of local customs and labour laws, and meals were intricately choreographed pieces of performance art. In short, in a world such as this, McKay and Shepard would probably rip the social fabric to shreds within 10 minutes of stepping through the gate. Attention to detail is highly valued among the Glietal, Shepard told Dr. Weir during one of their pre-mission briefing strategy sessions. They're not a violent people, but they distrust... She paused, looking for a delicate way to put it. Spontaneity. Disruptions in their established routines are frowned upon. Dr. Weir's mouth quirked. And by... frowned upon, you mean... Taylor ducked her head. For minor transgressions, such as using the wrong utensil at the table, there is a significant fine. For other, more serious disruptions, speaking out of turn, over familiar forms of address, there is usually a mandatory period of incarceration. Ah, said Dr. Weir, no doubt picturing the potential for prison break 531. Taylor looked at the ceiling, smiling slightly. I believe that Halling has some plans for an irrigation system which he is eager to discuss with Dr. McKay, she told Dr. Weir. It is not, perhaps, a matter of great urgency. I'll have Colonel Shepherd fly Dr. McKay out to the settlement this afternoon, said Dr. Weir. After all, sustainable agriculture is very important. Quite, said Taylor. And Ronan and I can go forward with negotiations as planned, so that we do not lose time. An excellent allocation of resources, Dr. Weir agreed. Footnote 5. On MG9-819, McKay managed to offend 7 of the 9 local gods in under 3 minutes by suggesting the inhabitants bathe with water instead of fermented milk. On PX0-839, Shepard inadvertently prompted a group of 14-year-old girls to overthrow the government. On PL2-176, McKay committed an unspeakable act with a goat, thus offending 3 gods, a goat, and the goat's owner. On M5R-012, Shepard was caught in a compromising position with the tavern wench and the tavern wench's husband, thus prompting the community killjoys to get their pitchforks and torches. Really, it was never a question of whether McKay and or Shepard would screw up, it was just a matter of how. Footnote 6. Surprisingly, SGA-1 only accounted for 74 of Atlantis's mission-related prison breaks. Field teams containing anthropologists had a much, much higher rate of incarceration, mainly because Drs. Tull, Ely and Villareal were devoted Marxist structuralists who felt it was their mission to organise cooperative labour collectives on planets with unfair labour practices. It's not that I don't support fair compensation for goods and labour, Dr. Weir said, leaning against the bars separating her from Dr. Tull and the rest of SGA-14. It's just that this is the fourth time in 5 weeks that we've had to bail you out for inciting a mob and encouraging a general strike, Why not try and work within the system next time? For the bureaucrat, the world is a mere object to be manipulated by him, said one of the Marines. All social rules and all relations between individuals are eroded by a cash economy, added another. Philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it, Sergeant Burns concluded. Dr. Tull smiled proudly. Dr. Weir thunked her head against the iron bars. I hate signing off on these mission reports, she said. O'Neill only has alien sex in his. Landry thinks I make this kind of crap up. Ha, said McKay, pointing at the video feed of Taylor and Roland in glitzy old prison garb. Vindication at last. Shepard shot McKay a look that was supposed to be disapproving, but came out more gleeful and self-righteous than was strictly necessary. Now, Rodney, he said seriously, there's no call to be rude. After all, I'm sure anyone can make a few teeny-tiny, culturally insensitive mistakes, resulting in arrest. Colonel, said Dr. Weir. Yes, Shepard said, all innocence. He had not been pleased with his demotion to taxi driver, any more than Rodney had wanted to play Athosian Gothic and brush up on his farming. Dr. Weir, Taylor's voice came through the gate, sounding tinny and very, very annoyed. I'm afraid that our communication time is being strictly monitored, so if we could... Yes, right, said Dr. Weir. What are the charges? Taylor looked extremely embarrassed. I believe the formal charges are aggravated rudeness and resisting arrest, she said. The warden has informed us that we will have to serve 7 days in their detainment facilities.
So what did the Incredible Hulk do this time? Asked Rodney. Gargle at the table, clean his teeth with the finger bones of infants. Roland snorted. He looked bored and rather terrifying, even in aggressively fuchsia prison robes. Wasn't me, he said. Taylor wouldn't eat the cake.
What?
Rodney looked appalled.
Mocking religious beliefs was just fine. Holy sites were meant to be desecrated. An incidental genocide sometimes just happened, regardless of the precautions one took. But refusing to eat cake was simply unnatural.
I respectfully declined, Taylor corrected Ronan. I was overly full and did not care for dessert.
Shepherd's mouth thinned in disapproval.
Rodney's eyes were shiny with disbelief and betrayal. Ronan looked like he thought the whole thing was hilarious, but was smart enough not to let Taylor know it.
I do not like chocolate, Taylor said, desperate. Elizabeth, surely there is some way to...
Dr. Weir shook her head sadly. I'm afraid there's nothing we can do for you, Taylor. Best just to do the time, she said. We'll see you in a week.
Some Russian guy, not the one who wrote War and Peace, the other one, once wrote that we can't expect to interrogate the infinite and receive a finite answer to our questions. This has to do with the gap between faith and reason and limitations of human understanding. Basically, the guy says that there are things that are knowable and things that just aren't, and we shouldn't get all bent out of shape when we can't get the puzzle pieces to fit. Really, though, this just explains why the how many surrealists does it take to screw in a light bulb joke is so damn funny. Footnote 7. It might have been the Russian guy, or it could have been the Bible, or maybe Douglas Adams. It's all the same, really. Footnote 8. Answer, fish. It was a beautiful night. The stars were bright, the moon was full, and there were any number of lovely mystic priestesses around for seduction purposes. So, naturally, Shepard was busy dragging McKay's drunk ass away from the festivities.
We've been over this before, McKay, John said.
Ronan's like 20 times your size. You are never going to be able to outdrink him.
You know what's sad?
Rodney hiccuped, swaying like a kid who'd been on the tilt-a-whirl a little too long. The fact that you're a 38-year-old physicist who thought he could win at beer pong?
No, McKay protested. I can too win at beer pong. They just cheated.
Sure they did. By making you lose, Shepard said, rolling his eyes. So, what's sad? Rodney's face crumpled.
Everything, he said.
Oh, Jesus, said Shepard, feeling a moment of manly panic. McKay, if you cry, I'm going to maroon you on the Lemon Tree Planet.
That's just it, McKay gestured to the Firelit Festival roaring along down the hill. Do you know how many people on Earth would kill to know about this?
Shepard raised an eyebrow. An alien kegger? McKay scowled.
No, aliens, the gate and wormholes and the ancients and Atlantis and everything. It's not fair to pretend we don't know about stuff we do so, no?
That's remarkably democratic of you, Rodney.
Canadian, McKay said, poking at John's chest. We're better at that stuff. Anyway, he said, regrouping. Did I ever tell you about... See, I met this guy at a bar once. Said Shepherd.
No, not like that, McKay scowled and then conceded. He was pretty hot, though.
Hey, is that some sort of requirement for the military? Because you're all hot.
Said Shepherd again. He felt it was worth repeating.
McKay ignored him. But this guy, he told me he was with the SGC, and I said, what's that? And there's... I'm 26, and there's a piece of paper he tells me to sign, and then he tells me there's this gate, and aliens, and wormholes, and the whole... everything, he gestured, sketching something much, much bigger than a bread box. It was just... McKay's voice cracked. I mean, I knew it had to be out there. I knew it. But then it was all there and I could see it. He was quiet for a moment and then said, but I had to promise not to tell. Sounding incalculably miserable, leaning heavily against Shepherd's left side. I couldn't tell anyone.
Well, yeah, buddy, John said, wrapping an arm consolingly around Rodney's shoulders. That's the idea of a confidentiality agreement. You get to know stuff, but you can't talk about it. Now, he said, scanning the gookskin tents. Any idea which one Taylor said was ours?
McKay shook his head once, twice, and turned green. No, he said, but...
When you found out, didn't you want to tell everyone so they could know?
And then threw up spectacularly over John's boots. Footnote 9. Actually, McKay broke his confidentiality agreement before he left for Atlantis, telling both his cat and his neighbour. His cat listened seriously to Rodney's explanation of wormholes and lost cities and ancients, and then went back to cleaning himself with his tongue, unsurprised by the government cover-up. He was a cat, after all, and distrust of the man is inherent in cats. McKay's neighbour just rolled her eyes and said, "Whatever, Dr. McKay, I'll take him. You don't have to lie about why you're abandoning your pet, you asshole." Grabbed the cat and shut the door in his face.
Really, this is all about purpose, and the existence of free will, if you like, because the two seem to be intimately related. Lots of intelligent, and incidentally long-winded, men and women have written endless pamphlets and books and bumper stickers on the subject over the years. The two main questions they seem to come up with in these very intelligent discussions are, 1. Do things happen because other things have happened in the past? That is, is there some sort of determined causality in the universe? And, 2. Can we do anything to change what will happen in the future? Does it matter what we choose? Or does the universe just sort of happen all around us, without taking any notice of what we do? So, there's all that to consider. Footnote 10. Look, read Hume and Hobbes and Hegel and Locke if you have to, but... For the love of God, stay away from Schopenhauer and Kant unless someone's got a gun to your head, or you're feeling particularly enterprising and masochistic. Just a suggestion.
So hey, said Shepherd, plopping down at the table across from Ronan. As of next double Sunday, you'll have been on Atlantis a year. We should do something.
Ronan speared a muffin with his fork. Yeah, he said, wary.
Yeah, agreed Shepherd, a team thing. We could get a couple of movies with lots of explosions, or maybe a couple seasons of Buffy, some beer, and bribe the commissionary staff to make cookies, or cupcakes.
Ronan brightened. Pie, he said.
Right, Shepherd grinned. Or pie.
No, Ronan said, biting off a piece of muffin. Not or pie, and pie. Cookies and cupcakes and pie.
Shepherd raised his eyebrows.
And pie, he repeated.
I like them all, Ronan shrugged. Why choose?
I have no idea, said Shepherd.
The end. Many thanks to the author for allowing me to record this fic. You can leave her feedback and read her other work at someinstant.livejournal.com.